Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, September 29th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, two cold fronts bring rain and wind both today and Tuesday. Fire update on the Blue and Log fires. Trump administration proposes to remove lookalike protections for 11 species. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Two cold fronts moving north are bringing rain and wind that we'll be seeing both today and Tuesday, with some lighter rain lingering throughout the week. Per National News Service, Eureka, Humboldt, Del Norte, and Mendocino counties will be seeing periods of moderate to heavy precipitation throughout the day. Humboldt and Del Norte counties will be seeing gusty southerly winds up to 30 miles per hour, while Mendocino will be seeing winds from 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tuesday will see increased rain and wind in the afternoon and evening, mostly in Humboldt and Del Norte. Winds may pick up to 30 to 50 miles per hour in these areas, with the strongest gusts on exposed ridges, coastal headlands, and channeled terrain. Mendocino will be seeing winds picking up to 20 to 30 miles per hour later in the day. Tree damage is possible, as well as high winds blowing objects off of porches and into yards and roadways, so be sure to secure and bring in any loose or unsecured objects. For up-to-date weather information, the website is weather.gov/Eureka. The Blue and Log fires have been burning in Siskiyou County for over a month now. They are at 83% and 97% contained, respectively, with relatively new fire personnel assigned to them, compared to the 764 people working on the Blue Fire alone at its peak. KMUD's Sigurd Bjorn has this report.
The Blue Fire was discovered on Tuesday, August 26th, 4 miles south of Syed on Walker Ridge in Siskiyou County, after thunderstorms brought intense lightning to the surrounding area in the Klamath National Forest. 2 days later, on August 28th, fire activity picked up, reaching sections of a direct fire line that had been constructed. At that time, the fire stood at a mere 134 acres, just a fraction of the 3,700 acres it would grow to be. It was still 0% contained a day later when the California Interagency Complex Incident Management Team took over management of the fire from the Forest Service. The interagency team had been managing the Dillon Fire, which at that time had just been showing signs of ebbing. During the next 2 days, the Blue Fire broke out for real, and on August 31st, the fire had grown by almost 1,000 acres, still being 0% contained. This massive spread was due to evening winds causing the fire to expand in all directions, past Blue Mountain and toward Grinder Creek. Evacuation warnings were issued for Syed Valley. At this point, 225 personnel were working on the fire. Over the next week, more than 500 personnel were added to the team as the fire ripped through another 2,000 acres. On Sunday, the 7th of September, the fire stood at 3,100 acres with 764 people working on it. Hotshot wildland firefighter crews were working out of spite camps, and fire crews conducted strategic firing operations to strengthen containment lines and protect the Syed Valley community, who had been issued with evacuation orders on September 2nd. Still, the fire was 0% contained. However, that day, September 7, there was a bit of a blessing from Mother Nature in the form of cloud cover and rain. A day later, the picture had changed dramatically. Although the rain brought with it unhealthy air, it had also doused the fire, bringing the first containment since the fire broke out almost 2 weeks earlier. By the end of Monday, September 8th, the Blue Fire was 13% contained. Despite more rain being forecast, the incident team continued to add personnel to the operation, and on September 9, the fire was 33% contained. Evacuation orders were downgraded to warnings, and children returned to school. In spite of this, the fire had still burned 500 new acres, bringing the total to 3,700. And authorities stressed the fire still posed significant risk to the Syed Valley community, which was experiencing unhealthy air quality. Over the next few days, the management team started to scale back the operations as the fire, even though still only about 30% contained, showed limited indication of growth. At that point, the log fire, which too was started on August 26 by lightning, was burning in the Marble Mountain Wilderness south of the Blue Fire. Due to its remoteness, the fire, although smaller by 2,000 acres, stayed uncontained much longer, with limited personnel assigned to it. On September 14th, the fire was left to its own devices, still 0% contained, holding at 1,100 acres, and posing no threat to communities. Today, September 29th, the log fire is 97% contained, and the blue fire is at 83%. No growth has been observed in the log fire, which is still being left unattended. While operations on the blue fire focus on mop-up, hazard tree mitigation, and suppression repair. Somewhat incredibly, there have been no reports of injuries or structural damage in the almost 5,000 acres that have been burned. That is good news indeed. But untold is the story of burned trees, dead or injured animals, and a shredded ecosystem which may take years, even decades, to recover. Not to mention the possible health-related damage, mental and physical, to residents and firefighters alike. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Sigurd Bjørn.
On Thursday, September 25th, the Trump administration proposed to remove protections for several species that look like other threatened and endangered wildlife. Under the similarity of appearance provisions of the U.S. Endangered Species Act, the designation is in place to prevent harm to actual endangered species and helps enforce wildlife laws by making it hard for illegal activities like poaching to exploit species that look similar but do not have the same protections. KMUD News spoke with Leah Comerford, a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, for more information on what this protection does.
So the Endangered Species Act is a federal law that was passed, I think, in the early 1970s. And, you know, the purpose of the act is to protect imperiled species and to, through that, the federal agencies list species that are threatened or endangered with extinction and then adopt rules and other actions and stuff to conserve and protect those species and hopefully bring them back to recovery so that they can be delisted and continue to exist in the world. And when Congress passed the Endangered Species Act, they realized, you know, a lot of species look alike, so it can be hard to determine for people out in wildlife and nature and for law enforcement officers to distinguish between one type of turtle and another type of turtle. And so they included a provision that allows for species that aren't yet imperiled to be treated as threatened or endangered species and protected by the act if those protections would protect the imperiled species.
The endangered species threatened range from butterflies like the Miami blue butterfly to fish like the shovelnose sturgeon. The administration also proposed revising protections for reptiles like bog turtles, desert tortoises, and Pearl River map turtles.
So, for example, there is a butterfly called the Miami blue butterfly. It's an endangered butterfly that's found in Florida and Fish and Wildlife. So that butterfly is protected by the Endangered Species Act. There's also several other blue butterflies that look like the Miami blue butterfly, and it's hard to tell the difference between them. And so those other blue butterflies are also currently protected by the act, but the Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to remove the protections for those three butterflies. And it's doing that for a number of species, including puma, which looks like a Florida panther, sturgeon species, and then also making some changes to rules that are intended to protect turtles.
According to Fish and Wildlife, quote, "We are proposing these changes to eliminate unnecessary regulation and to ensure species treated as endangered or threatened meet the required criteria," end quote. There are currently 17 protected look-alike species, and under this proposal, 11 of them will be delisted.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just one in a long line of actions that we've seen from this administration or that we're expecting based on just like news reporting and what we've heard so far that are going to have a really detrimental impact to endangered and threatened species. So I think that, you know, law enforcement officials rely on these protections to make it easier for them to, and presumably faster, you know, when they're making a determination, oh, is this species allowed to be traded like this? Can we issue a permit for this type of trade? Now all of a sudden there's going to be potentially more confusion and maybe misidentification and stuff of species and more legal activity or illegal activity that is, you know, misrepresented and happening just because the lookalike species are no longer going to be protected. But I think, you know, generally speaking, the administration has taken a number of actions that are going to be already and are going to have significant impacts on, you know, biodiversity in this country. And this is just one, unfortunately, of many of those.
The public can submit comments to U.S. Fish and Wildlife until October 26th. To submit public comments, the website is federalregister.gov. Turning to Mendocino. Mendocino faces $300 million shortfall as department heads push back against hiring freeze. Mendo Local Public Media's Elise Cox reports.
Mendocino County is facing a new $3 million shortfall as department heads push back on a flexible hiring freeze. Among them is the district attorney's office, which last week threatened to bring a lawsuit to force the county to pay for the staff it needs. Reporting for KMUD News and Mendo Local Public Media, I'm Elise Cox. Last spring, one of the budget balancing proposals embraced by the Board of Supervisors was a flexible hiring freeze accompanied by a strategic hiring process. This, coupled with a request to department heads to reduce their budgets by 6%, was supposed to lead to $6 million in savings. It hasn't.
At this time, 2 months into fiscal year 25-26, the county is only trending at a $3 million in savings.
That's Darcy Antle, Chief Executive Officer of Mendocino County. Assistant District Attorney Scott McMenemy addressed the board at last week's meeting, calling a policy of eliminating unfilled positions that are not being actively recruited for after 6 months, quote, completely arbitrary.
Our office is already understaffed. I don't know any other county in this state where the district attorney has fewer deputy DAs than the public defender's office. In addition, we have many more responsibilities, including search warrants, charging cases, reviewing cases, things of that nature. We already have a very high caseload per employee. Our elected DA alone has tried 10 cases last year. That's unheard of.
McMenemy argued that specialized legal positions can't be filled quickly.
There's no pool of qualified candidates locally for us to choose from to fill a chief deputy district attorney, a level 4 deputy district attorney, or a level 3 deputy district attorney. Those positions require 4 years of advanced education, a Juris Doctorate degree, 5 to 10 years practical experience with ongoing education to fulfill their obligations. Since we have to hire out of county, in fact, we do save money because this county is not paying for all that education.
He warned that current staff is dangerously overloaded.
Without our ability to recruit, it's going to place an unsafe burden on our current employees, both their physical and mental health.
And he suggested the county is being penny-wise and pound foolish.
This decision to remove vacant positions that are unfilled will cost the county money in the long run. It will jeopardize public safety, and it will not save any money to the county.
He raised the possibility of taking legal action.
California Constitution, Article 13, Section 35, public safety is the first responsibility of local government. And I know my time's running short, so I'm going to run short here. Government Code 25303, the Board of Supervisors shall supervise conduct of all county officers. Quote, this section shall not be construed to affect the independent and constitutionally and statutorily designated investigative and prosecutorial functions of the district attorney. The BOS shall not obstruct the investigative and prosecutorial functions of the DA. I was here during the Norm Broman years when it was a very acrimonious relationship with the board. I don't want to go down that road again, but we are able to if we have to. If we have to hire the AG's office to come in and prosecute, if we have to fund and hire people, be reimbursed by you later through litigation, we'll do that. We don't want to do that.
Supervisor Ted Williams expressed sympathy, but he also noted that the county was facing a fundamental lack of funds that is projected to get worse next year.
The issue is the dollars don't exist. This county needs to cut $16 million by June. And so we hear the request for more roads, better conditioned roads, better staffing, focus on public safety. The county basically spends its discretionary dollars on public safety. About 3/4 of our overall funding is going to public safety. The remainder is the departments that fund public safety, like the assessor, the tax collector, auditor. It's bare bones today, and it's about to get worse. And so the hope is we can have some collaboration between the board, the district attorney, the sheriff, because if the fight is over there not being enough money available, it's not a fight about how to allocate it. The only power this board has is to say, well, we could have less sheriff and more DA, or vice versa.
The Board of Supervisors ended up approving the policy to delete vacancies lasting 6 months or longer after receiving assurance from Human Resources Director Sherry Johnson the positions could be reopened if qualified candidates were found.
If the department has a request to open this position, we can add the position back onto the position allocation table.
In addition to the staffing shortage, the district attorney's office is coping with a grassroots effort to recall District Attorney David Eister. Opponents have filed the required notice of intent to recall, accompanied by 60 valid signatures. Eister has responded with a statement defending his, quote, nonpartisan record of prosecution. The next hurdle for his opponents is to gather the required 8,200 valid signatures that are needed to put the recall effort on the ballot. Reporting for Mendo Local Public Media and KMUD News, I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, teacher shortage hampers Proposition 28 arts education hiring, Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Proposition 28, or the Arts in Music and Schools Funding Guarantee and Accountability Act, gives California school districts about $1 billion per year for arts education. But advocates say some school districts are having a hard time finding staff and navigating program requirements. Districts have to spend each year's funding by the end of the school year or return the money. Kyle Holmes with the California County Superintendents says the state's teacher shortage presents a real challenge, especially for small rural districts.
If a school district has 500 or more students, 80% of it needs to be used to hire staffing. In smaller districts, there are a lot of folks posting openings for new music teachers and new theater teachers that will sit for 6 months at a time and not have any applicants and not be filled.
Holmes adds that arts education improves creative thinking and boosts grades in other subjects. More than 2,200 local education agencies are receiving Prop 28 funding, which is intended to help them hire more staff in dance, media arts, music, theater, and visual arts. School districts that don't want to leave money on the table can get help online by using resources available through the county superintendents, the nonprofit Create California, and the State Department of Education. Just over half of local education agencies have fewer than 500 students. Kate Stover with the Tulare County Office of Education says one district in Lassen County serves just 3 students and got $625 in Prop 28 funds.
It isn't always enough to be able to pay for a full-time teacher, but there are ways to work with outside partners and to leverage existing resources to really bring more arts for kids.
Los Angeles Unified gets almost $75 million a year from Prop 28 to offer arts education to more than 381,000 students. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu doubles down in the face of global pressure to stop war in Gaza, KPFA's Sharon Sabata reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was greeted by delegates who turned their backs on him and walked out of the United Nations meeting where he spoke today.
Please, order in the hall.
Netanyahu gave a defiant speech despite growing international isolation over his refusal to end the devastating war in Gaza. Netanyahu started his United Nations address today with a non-nuanced, elementary school-style pop quiz.
Who has murdered Americans and Europeans in cold blood? Is it A, Al-Qaeda, B, Hamas, C, Hezbollah, D, Iran, or E, all of the above? Correct. Again. So here's the point I wanted to make. Our enemies hate all of us with equal venom. They want to drag the modern world back to the past, to a dark age of violence, fanaticism, and terror.
Netanyahu praised U.S. President Donald Trump.
President Trump understands better than any other leader that Israel and America face a common threat. He showed the world that when Iran and its proxies murder Americans, take Americans hostage, shout death to America, burn American flags, and try to assassinate the President of the United States, not once, but twice. He showed them there is a price to pay for all that.
He slammed the countries that have announced recognizing Palestinian statehood.
What you're doing is giving the ultimate reward to intolerant fanatics who perpetrated and supported the October 7th massacre. Giving the Palestinians a state 1 mile from Jerusalem after October 7th is like giving Al-Qaeda a state 1 mile from New York City after September 11th.
Nida Laffy was part of a large group of people who gathered outside of the UN in protest of Netanyahu's appearance.
Thousands of people came out to the streets of New York City to protest against him being here, against his address, and against the 2 years of ongoing genocide that the U.S. has supported Israel throughout. People see the truth through these lies. We saw today so many people got up and walked out of Netanyahu's address, right? And that's indicative of how much the narrative and the truth has really prevailed in the past 2 years. World leaders can say what they want to say. They can spew the narratives they want to spew. But the truth is the people are watching a genocide and the people are seeing through that.
Reporting for Pacifica, KPFA, I'm Sharon Savoda.
Georgetown University is in the national spotlight this week after flyers posted on campus were referred to the FBI. KPFA's Dahlia Lozier reports.
Georgetown University public safety officials removed and handed over to the FBI flyers that were posted around campus earlier this week that referenced the recent assassination of Charlie Kirk. The flyers gained national attention after Turning Point USA spokesperson Andrew Colvin posted a photo of one on X. Some flyers depicted a censored image of Charlie Kirk, while others boasted phrases that were written on a bullet casing found at the scene of Kirk's assassination. Other flyers had captions that read, quote, "the only political group that celebrates when Nazis die," and, quote, "do something more than symbolic resistance." All flyers displayed QR codes that linked to a Google form and invited students to join the John Brown Club. By Friday morning, the QR code directed users to a link that stated the documents were no longer accessible due to violations of Google's terms of service. The flyers referenced John Brown, a radical abolitionist who became a national figure in the 1850s for his violent campaign against slavery. In 1859, he led a raid on the federal armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, hoping to arm enslaved people and spark a rebellion. Brown was ultimately captured and tried, becoming the first American to be executed for treason. A Fox News article recently published about the flyers links the Georgetown John Brown Club to an organization called the John Brown Gun Club, a largely decentralized fringe movement associated with Redneck Revolt, a group that sometimes refers to itself as anti-fascist, but whose members come from across the political spectrum. The incident has garnered national attention, with Department of Education Secretary Linda McMahon tweeting Thursday night, quote, "allowing violent rhetoric to fester on our nation's campuses without consequences is dangerous. It must be condemned by institutional leaders." Cash Moore, a Georgetown sophomore, spoke to Fox News on Thursday about his concern that the Trump administration will retaliate against Georgetown as an institution.
I think the first thing I thought was a little disappointment that some people perhaps on this campus hold that violence is something that is productive in society. And my second thought was kind of a worry that if this ended up blowing out of proportion, that we might be the next target to like get defunded. Like if Trump, you know, somehow saw this. We already have Lyndon McMahon posting on X about it, Ted Cruz posting. I think one of the things I worried about is Trump going to target us next? You know, we already have National Guard outside, which I think has been scary for a lot of students.
For its part, the university has issued a statement that reads, quote, "Georgetown University has no tolerance for calls for violence or threats to the university. Upon discovering the new flyers, the university removed them and reported them to the FBI. The episode at Georgetown this week is just one example of the federal government and its partner institutions' recent crackdown on free speech in America. On Thursday, President Donald Trump directed his administration to look into funders of what his officials dubbed left-wing terrorism, naming two top Democratic donors, billionaires George Soros and Reid Hoffman, in an alleged conspiracy to finance violent protests against the government. Trump's directive Thursday put the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in charge of the investigation and said the effort would be conducted by various agencies across the administration, including the Treasury Department, which was directed to, quote, identify and disrupt financial networks that fund domestic terrorism and political violence. Kash Patel condoned this action at a press conference.
People and organizations have collected funds and put them out into the streets of America and organized violence across our country. And thanks to your recognition of this and this executive order and the AG's leadership to lead out and prosecute these individuals, we are properly going to chase them down like the domestic terrorists that they are.
The incident is similar to one that occurred recently at UC Berkeley, in which 160 faculty and students had their names sent to the Trump administration in a federal investigation into alleged anti-Semitic incidents. Many affected individuals had little information about the allegations or chance to respond, raising concerns about academic freedom and free speech. Like the Georgetown Flyer incident, the case highlights growing federal scrutiny of political activity on college campuses. A representative from South Carolina, Nancy Mace, has already called for retribution against the university. In a post on X on Wednesday, she replied to Turning Point USA's spokesperson Colvett, saying, quote, defund all tax dollars, not one single dime. For KPFA News, I'm Dahlia Lozier.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The father of Emily Pike has filed a civil lawsuit against the Mesa Group home that had the San Carlos Apache teen in its custody before she went missing and was murdered in Arizona. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
The seven-page complaint alleges Sacred Journey Inc. Group Home staff were negligent in failing to keep Emily in their care, blaming them for her, quote, wrongful death.
If they had kept her safe, would this have happened? We don't know.
Olivia Lamoraco is with the Phillips Law Group. The Department of Child Safety found back in April a few deficiencies, but once the facility corrected them, no further action was taken.
Their investigation came too late, unfortunately, for Emily. I know they've made small changes, but it doesn't change the facts of what happened.
The personal injury law firm in Phoenix is representing Emily's biological dad, Jensen Pike, who has been behind bars since before she disappeared in late January. He's seeking unspecified damages for forever being deprived of his child.
You know, I can't speak for any other family member or Emily's mom. The answer is I don't know if she's pursuing anything.
Sacred Journey, Inc. did not respond for comment, but has 20 days to reply to his complaint that also looks to recoup funeral and burial costs. The San Carlos Apache tribe provided at least $5,000 for Emily's funeral, but that didn't cover everything. Emily's remains were found in garbage bags back in February along an Arizona highway, over 100 miles away from where she was last seen at the group home. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Billings, Montana hosted its second annual Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Vigil and Community Meal to honor loved ones and rally around justice and healing. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Advocacy group Warrior Women for Justice convened the vigil Friday morning with a smudging ceremony on the Yellowstone County Courthouse lawn. Nikki Wege with Warrior Women for Justice is of Salga and Umaha and says this gathering is an opportunity for community members to honor their loved ones in solidarity.
To not only remember the stolen, but to bring awareness, seek advocacy, seek justice and accountability, and to speak for those who have been silenced.
According to a 2020 report from the Montana Department of Justice, indigenous people make up less than a tenth of the state's population, but roughly 25% of all missing persons.
Today, it does not matter if you call upon the Lord to hear your prayers or if you turn to all four directions while burning sacred herbs to lift your pleas. What matters today is standing together as one to roll away the stone that's blocking the government and the media and our own families and communities from acting. We stand together to give life to hope.
After speeches and reading a list of the missing and murdered, attendees share a meal, stories, and healing crafts like painting and weaving. Wege says Warrior Women for Justice will roll out a series of recordings from the event to highlight some of those stories. For National Native News, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Ernie Stevens Jr. is being remembered for his contributions to Indian Country, serving as chairman of the Indian Gaming Association for more than two decades. Stevens, a citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, passed away suddenly on Friday at age 66. The Indian Gaming Association says Stevens was a strong advocate for Native rights, and his legacy includes a record of policy victories and economic achievements in Indian gaming. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Sigur Bjorn, Elise Cox, Sharon Sabota, Dahlia Lozier, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report on what's happening around Mendocino? KMA News is looking for stringer reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kmud for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.